Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming to our Industry, Entrepreneurship, and Management edition of our panel series for the BEST program. Some of you may be aware of what the BEST program is all about, but just to give you a reminder of our central focus. So our goal is to provide individualized training for PhD students that may want to pursue career tracks outside of academia, say in science, policy, communication, industry, management, entrepreneurship, et cetera. So that I'll bring off to Tiffany.
I just wanted to introduce Tiffany and Diona.
Hi, my name is Ken. I'm a third-year PhD student in bioengineering.
Yeah, and we would like to have the panel introduce themselves. So you can start here.
My name is Chris Thomas. I'm the CTO of Whitetronics, a local startup that works on radioisotope battery. I'm a PhD graduate from Cornell Electrical Engineering. We started the company while I was still doing my PhD and grew it to the point where we could start out in the community, get an office, move forward. And now we're maturing the technology, moving forward.
Hi, I'm BJ Borman. I've recently retired after 25 years of working in a big pharmaceutical company. Half that time was with Pfizer, half that time was with a German pharmaceutical house called Boehringer Ingelheim. I did business development in both of those places. I'm currently CEO of a small startup company in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, and I'm also Chief Business Officer of a small company that does a drug delivery device in Austin, Texas. I manage both of these jobs sitting in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I'm Stephen Smith with CYC. We're a triad of investment, consult, and also custom photonics, lasers, optics, spanning many different application spaces. I'm a PhD graduate from Cornell. My three great accomplishments at Cornell, in ascending order, were number one, convincing a couple of professors I knew something about nonlinear optics. I don't know how I did that. Number two, Hans Bethe once asked me a question in that room, which I knew the answer to. I don't know if he was being disingenuous, but it definitely fit the mantra of never being the smartest guy in the room. And I met my wife here and convinced her to marry me. That was my biggest accomplishment.
My name is David Putnam. I'm faculty in biomedical engineering and chemical engineering here at our fine university. My office is in Weill Hall. Prior to coming to Cornell, I was a postdoc in Boston and helped start a company called Transform Pharmaceuticals, which grew to about 100 people and was sold to Johnson & Johnson in 2005. And on my sabbatical, so I had the industrial experience of taking an idea and growing it into a company. And then for my sabbatical, I needed to get the venture capital side of entrepreneurship. And so I did a sabbatical with PureTech Ventures in Boston and started a company called Entrega Pharmaceuticals, which is off and running in the Cambridge area.
So you've also had such interesting experiences and unconventional career tracks. How would you say that these differ from the so-called normal career track that most PhDs envision? Would you like to go down the line?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm from Jamaica, and the way we think of your career is to get the highest degree you can get, and then find a very big company. Preferably something within an international base, and continue to move up as high as you can in the company. Learn as much as you can, move into management. And that was my game plan from day one. However, once I got into the PhD proper, and we started doing research in different areas, and we looked at these things, and the ideas started coming, which always do. And we latched onto one that we thought was worthwhile to spin out into a company. And after a while, being an entrepreneur, you have to have the personality for it. You have to have be comfortable being able to do a lot of different jobs. And what happened was, once we started doing that, I realized that this was something that was definitely for me. I liked the way it operated. I liked the challenges that come along every day. I like interacting with the different companies that we deal with, because you have to kind of figure out how your technology will help. And sometimes you have to figure out what they're doing before you can tell them how you can help them. So things change a lot. You're dealing with technology constantly, not just yours, but also the people that you're interacting with. And I think once I got to that point in the early stages, I realized that this was for me, and we kept at it and grew the company out to the point where, you know, we're moving along. So I think it is, I look at, from my background, this is highly non-technical, non-traditional for me. Most of my family in Jamaica, when they say, oh, so you own a company, how's it going? What is going, we're early stage, so we're not selling anything. There's no income, there's nothing. So they can't understand that because that's not a reality in Jamaica. And so for me, that's very non-traditional, but very enjoyable on my part and very challenging. And I wake up every day, look at, get ready to go. It's very interesting.
So I have to say, I started on what would be considered a traditional route. I did my postdoctoral fellowship at Yale Medical School and was convinced that this is where I wanted to be. I don't think I saw sunshine. I looked like a vampire most of my 20s because I was in lab 24/7, and that's really where I wanted to be. I was very happy. I was very happy. Complete and total nerd, very happy. Then reality hit, and I actually got married, and I got pregnant, and I realized I was never going to see this child. So I decided maybe I should look for a job. And I'm old enough that there was still something of a stigma in moving from academia, particularly an institution like Cornell or Yale, and moving into the industrial space. There was still, you were letting people down. People were disappointed in you that you were moving there. And the first job I took was actually at Boehringer Ingelheim, which was also German pharmaceutical company, mid-size. They only have about 40,000 people, so on and so forth. But it was like going to Disneyland for me. It was unreal, where I had to worry about where I was going to get, whose fax scan I was going to be able to use, or whose peptide synthesizer I could bum time off of, and how I was going to afford the reagents. Boehringer said, well, what do you want for your lab? And I gave them a huge list, and I had my own fax scan and my own peptide synthesizer and my own diet. I was like, where is the downside to this? This is pretty amazing. During that time, I'd have to say I did have a course correction, and I wasn't a scientist anymore. I went to Pfizer, completely personal reasons. My husband was at Pfizer. I was at Boehringer Ingelheim. Connecticut's a pretty small state, but still to get from one corner to the other is a couple of hours. And with small kids, it just didn't make a lot of sense. So for personal reasons, he tried to get a job at my company. I tried to get a job at his company, and I guess I won because I got a job at Pfizer, but it wasn't in science. It was in business development. And business development was nothing that I sought out. It was nothing that I planned to do. And in fact, when the first time the attorneys came to me and said, okay, you've got to draft out the definitions for this contract, I said, what are you talking about? I don't know how to do that. I know how to write a scientific paper, but I don't want to read these contracts and documents. The fine print just puts you to sleep and so on and so forth. Anyway, to make a long story short, I grew to really love it, really, really love it, because it used much more of my brain power than even being in the lab did. And I always said, if you're bored in the lab, you only have yourself to blame, because there are always fantastic things to do. And yes, you're constantly proving yourself wrong and your hypotheses wrong, but that's the nature of the game. In business development, it's dealing with people, it's dealing with their reactions, it's as Chris said, looking for the fit of the technologies into what Pfizer was trying to do or what Boehringer Ingelheim was trying to do, and trying to get that cooperation. It's negotiating deals. I'm a pretty shy person, and that was a real character challenge for me, to sit with people screaming and yelling at you, and they wanted this way, and you're sitting there and saying, okay, I'm representing Pfizer, I can't give in, it was a real career correction. But it's something that I never would have, in retrospect, I'm so happy and I'm so fortunate that I was able to do that. So it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And I know more about law and contracts than I ever want to, but it's been all good, all good.
Well, I have a couple comments. First of all, I had no intention ever, thinking back to graduate school, of going into this lifestyle or getting into this area. So I want to reassure you that just by being present in this room, you're so far ahead of where I was many decades ago. And I think generally, I'm still exposed a lot to the university academics. About a third of our business is done with universities and in the research sector. And I see the shift that you're much more savvy as a body than we were as graduate students in the 80s and the 90s. the big breakthrough moment for me, I was running the laser facility down here, down in Clark, and I was approached by a laser company, completely unsolicited, saying, we need a manager for Northeast region. And I had never, no sales experience, no management experience. I'd actually worked in industry as a research chemist. And 3 weeks later, I started the job. That's how quickly it happened. And this was a company that was looking forward in terms of it wanted its sales engineers, in particular its managers, to be able to speak the language of the customer. So they were hiring more and more PhDs. The first guy, actually, the company is Coherent, and the CEO of the company was the very first PhD hired salesperson in the industry. Now this is probably the majority of them are at least masters or higher. So I was a beneficiary of a forward-looking company in terms of getting people from academia into the business side via the sales route. Sales is like the entrepreneurship 101. You see the business from the prospecting of a lead in the very beginning all the way to collecting the bill, right? So you see everything, you know, the whole business cycle, bad debt from margins, from shipments, setting customer expectations. I love that. I did that for 15 years, moving up through various positions. About 10 years ago, many of the companies I was dealing with were being invested by small private venture, and I realized there was this niche for a sales and marketing consult, if you will. Most of the companies were technology-based. They didn't have, they did not have the expertise in marketing and sales to push their products and grow the business. And at that point, I decided I would do that as my, you know, late in life, second, last two phases of my career before retirement, with some encouragement from the private venture, laughing at me, saying, I remember once I said, so how many companies need help like this? And they just laugh. They all do, right? They have great ideas. They have some ideas about implementation, but when it comes to marketing and sales, that's the big hole. So that kind of took me where I am today, where that's one of the roles we fill on top of investment. And the photonic space is fascinating because I'm exposed to such a wide range of applications. I go from marking bagels to semiconductor inspection. So it's just so darn interesting in terms of the people you meet. Life science, I've got a lot of friendships in imaging, microscopy. So you just never know what's going to hit you when you get up in the morning, and that keeps the technology geek part of me alive and thriving. I will say, building a sales team, I took a bridge job with a European company building a North American team, and putting together a bunch of professionals, that was probably the most rewarding thing I did on the business side. I love doing that. That was creating a sales team that worked together and gelled together. That's a good skill. It's probably inside many of you, and you it's difficult to find, but it's that's led me today to some of the stuff. I do the sales development for most of these companies because that's my passion too.
Steve, BJ, and Chris, I enjoyed listening to your answers, but I forgot what the question was.
So how would you say that your career path kind of differs from what would be considered more a normal path by graduate students?
Okay, so when you go to graduate school, you're driven by your curiosity, and you think this is something you want to do. And I think that mindset should pervade through not only graduate school, but also your next career. So BJ went from the bench into business development. She said she didn't understand, but I bet she was following her curiosity. She thought it was probably a pretty cool thing, and luckily it panned out. So in the traditional sense, you know, PhD student needs to focus on getting their dissertation done. I mean, that's what they need to do. But what makes it not a normal experience is when during that process you begin to think, how could this be useful? So I'm in the College of Engineering, we use fundamental principles to make something that's going to be useful. You build a bridge, or you put in a pacemaker. It's something that intellectual property and entrepreneurship is intrinsic into that training. And so, it's not untraditional. So if you go into pure sciences, you do pure science, and it's science for the beauty of science. And in engineering, you're actually trying to make something. So to me, engineering is an entrepreneurial track anyway. is realizing that during your PhD, that will help you be even more successful at it, because if you can see the nuances of this small little thing, yeah, I'm going to take 20 steps to do this now in the lab, but boy, to actually make it practical, I should do it in two. All right, and that's going to increase the value tremendously by an order of magnitude. And if you start thinking that way early on, the track that you're on, it won't be a different track. It'll just be your PhD on steroids, because you've thought about those things ahead of time during your training. I followed my curiosity because I was following my wife. So we went to Boston. She went to graduate school, and she supported my sorry butt through graduate school. And so I'd be a schmuck if I didn't support her during her graduate school. So that's where the company came in. I sent out my academic research proposals. It turns out one of those ideas was a better company idea than an academic idea. I had no interest in going into a company at all. I had every interest in staying married to my wife. And so I had to figure out how to balance those two things. But I followed the curiosity. Could I have kept banging on the door of academia at that time? The answer is yes, but here was an opportunity to do something that was completely different. I was curious about it, and I just followed it, and I was lucky. Not everyone was as lucky, but that's, I don't know if that's a decent answer or not, but that's what I'm going to say. It's my story, and I'm sticking with it.
If I might ask one more question before soliciting questions from the audience. It seems like all of you have had to reinvent yourselves in some interesting ways, as well as reinventing your skill set
six times.
Yeah. What would you, if you could go back to as a graduate student and give yourself one piece of advice, what would you tell yourself?
Stay open to everything. I mean, it's interesting that you say that we've redefined ourselves. At this stage of it, after doing this for almost 10 years now, I'm not certain if it feels like it's a redefinition as a more an exposure. Okay. It's exposing different facets of your personality, and the curiosity is definitely the truth. That's what drives you. And you know, there's people skills, there's interaction, you know, with suppliers, all these things that you wouldn't normally think that as an engineer, as a student in the lab, that you would normally just think that you'd be good at on a large scale. You might be good at it on a small scale. You have to order a new tube or order a new something. You get to that quite easily. But you wouldn't think necessarily that you could change the order and have them produce a totally different product. I mean, for our company, I've had to go into, you know, at the time when we were just a two-person company, you have to walk into a room of a multinational company and tell them why they need to make a new product for you to develop your technology. I mean, that's not something I thought that I would be doing. So it's more an exposure. While you're in the lab, while you're doing, of course, your PhD is your main focus, but there are little things off that. So for instance, I mentioned ordering something. Get to know your suppliers. Ask them questions. Find out why it is that you can't get the thing that you need. If you think there's some twist off what you want, find out why it's not there. Push more. Ask questions. Get exposed to 360 degrees around whatever it is that you're doing. You know, learn the vendors, learn the equipment, learn everything. I mean, in my lab, I remember we had mass flow controllers, you know, going for the gases. It was just too expensive to calibrate them. And the tools that they used to do it, you know, we just didn't have them in the lab. So I had to learn how to do that. I never thought I would have been able, you know, they look so complex. I didn't know anything about them, never used them before I came to Cornell. And, you know, you have to learn to do that. But again, you have to be open to see everything, you know, your main research and everything around it 360 degrees.
Thank you.
I would have to say that I didn't appreciate until much later in my career how important a network is and how important it is to work your network actively. When I was a graduate student, I was perfectly content to be in my lab, do my work, talk to my colleagues, talk to the other postdocs in the lab, the graduate students in the lab. Maybe I got to know the other people in the department. Maybe I had a few collaborations with a few other people in other departments, but it didn't go outside of Yale. You know, I really didn't network hard outside of Yale. And if I was giving myself advice today on what I did back then, it would be to actively network more externally. You all have friends that are doing different things. You know, some of them might be already in jobs in big engineering firms or big corporate finance or whatever. And how well are you network with them? What are they doing? What are they asking for? Even with Chris was saying, talking to your suppliers, you know, talking to the guy that sells you stuff from Sigma Catalog or whatever, what's his job like? You know, what does he do? And does he travel a lot? And does he like it? Just to really ask a lot of questions, even asking people for time to talk about what their life is like and what their job experiences are like. Never occurred to me to you know, if you saw a speaker, to say, can I have an hour of your time? I'd really, or half an hour of your time, or a cup of coffee with you and just talk about things going forward. I never had that kind of maturity or retrospect to actually be able to say it's time to develop your network no matter what you're going to do. Even if you're going to stay in the academic track, it's really useful to have a lot of contacts at a lot of different universities in order to collaborate. So I would say that would be the most important piece of advice that I would give myself. Now I live and die by my network, and I talk to dozens of people every day, and it's one of the advantages of coming from a big company like Pfizer that's been downsizing and expanding and downsizing and expanding is I know somebody very well at virtually every other major pharmaceutical company in the world because they're all ex-Pfizer people and we all work together at a certain time. So. But networking is really important because it's much too comfortable to just stay in your environment and try to do good science.
Did everyone see my flinch? I knew I had about a 10% chance of not of someone picking networking before me. Thanks, BJ. I think this morning on my phone I have 9,700 contacts. Okay, these are not all people I know and would have for Thanksgiving, but that is the name of the game. It's that simple. All of this mantra about the web connecting us and, you know, making the world flat and being able to, from the business standpoint, from the personal development standpoint, that's all false. When you do business, you look at Silicon Valley as a model, you realize the power of Silicon Valley is that people tell everybody everything. You know, the legal stuff aside, ideas are thrown out, shared, but it's done intimately. It's done in small groups. It's done over small meetings. It's done in coffee sessions, in small group gatherings. That's the power of that atmosphere. And the same thing exists in Cambridge, in the biotech sector, in Boston, and in New York. I always ask, engaging as a graduate student, I said, well, okay, here's your studies. How's your networking? I got an email back from a young lady saying, my professor said, I've got to focus on getting my work done. Don't worry about networking until you're looking for a job. I wanted to get in my car, drive down, and shoot this guy. And this was just, you know, the day to start networking is day one, right? When you show up at school, you have to get that mindset in that this is building a connection of people. The web has taken the job hunt, you know, spraying resumes out is ineffective. You know, the spray of companies are resorting to taking things and just culling lists with search engine optimization. This is not a good strategy, right, to getting a position. Locating the hiring people, having the fortitude to get around the HR runaround. I'm sorry, I can't talk to you. You have to send your resume to HR. Oh, you can send it in. That's fine. Never lose. There's not a manager in the world who will not want to talk to someone who could solve her problem. Okay, doesn't matter what the rules of the company are. I've got a problem in my department, I'm responsible for it. If I can find the right person, the talent, to solve that problem, I want to talk to those people. I don't care what HR says because they don't care if my problem isn't solved. They've got a different set of problems. So understanding that is critical. To move off networking, the biggest transition I had to make was the concept, coming from a scientist standpoint, in business, it's idea plus implementation, okay? You have to put some constants on there, otherwise you have a units problem, but idea plus implementation is important. And as scientists, we're focused on idea, and we think a great idea is a business plan. And that was a rude shock to me that, in fact, they're equal partners, and more often than not, the implementation changes the idea. We're not used to thinking like that as scientists. We have a breakthrough idea, it's great, but we then think, okay, now we just have to figure out how to do it, but we get stuck on this. Those are the companies that have problems. Okay, those successful ones move from the idea to implementation. Uh-oh, we better go back and look at what we're doing and rethink this. That was a big jump. I remember realizing that probably 10, 12 years after I'd left academia. It's a different mindset that takes some adjustment. But networking is by far number one.
That is very good advice. I'll put in the academic sense. So you become assistant professor, you're doing your work, you're working for 4 or 5 years, and then you put together your dossier with your manuscripts and they send it out. And essentially, you're taking your diary of your science and you're putting it out there for other people to take pot shots at. It's pretty much what it is, right? And then people write letters on your behalf saying, yeah, this person is good, or this person's not very good, or is not progressing. And having built a network prior to that, long before that, during your postdoc, during your PhD, build that network so that when they see your dossier, they know already that you're already biased. They're already biased in their mindset that this person's good, right? And then they read it, and you just have to prove that you're good, right? But building that network, and what I say to my students also, and not even just my personal students, but my classes, is be nice to every single person you meet. It is a small community, and all you need is one person to say, that person's a jerk, and your network goes. It's that easy. Be nice to every single person you meet. Even if the person is being a jerk to you, smile, turn around. Just like kindergarten taught you this. Smile, turn around, walk away, right? And kick their butt somewhere else. Right? Scientifically, academically, however you do it, that's fine. No problem, right? But you don't attack back. Suck it up. Move on. That is the best advice I got, is to be very, very nice to every single person you meet. The other one is time management. Right, time management. So BJ was working at night, all night long. One, she works hard, but two, she didn't have the management skills yet to do the work from 7 in the morning to 5 at night. Is that true?
Oh,
okay.
By all means.
Yeah, and I did the exact same thing.
I still have that issue.
Yeah. Right. I did the exact same thing. In order to succeed in both academia as well as entrepreneurship and industry, you've got 2,000 things coming at you all at once. And to be able to grab it, it's like playing in the Matrix. Right, so the movie Matrix, does anyone know what I'm talking about? I hope so, yeah. All right, it's taking all this information and organizing it in a way that you can understand very, very easily, right? And then be able to prioritize them and say, this is what I need to do first, and this is why, and this is how much time I had to do it. Don't give yourself 2 weeks to do something you can do in a week. Do the darn thing in a week so you can move on to the second thing, right? Give yourself a very specific amount of time to get something done, work on it as hard as you possibly can during that time frame, and move on and be done with it. Don't say, I'm gonna do this other one first because it's more interesting. Tough cookies. Do the first thing first because it's the highest priority. All right, time management skills will get you very far, and then managing your network. Oh, one thing about managing your network, though. Everyone knows if you're managing it without being, truthful is not the right word. You're interested in that person because you're interested in that person, not because you want them on your network. Right? It has to be genuine.
It's a give and take.
Yes. And it's not, hey, let's go have some coffee because you're an important person. I want to get to know you. And I can tell all my friends, hey, I get to know this person. That's irrelevant. It's, go out for coffee, that's fine. If you really know that person. It's not take someone who's, a bigwig and invite them out for coffee just because you want to have coffee with this person. You see right through that. And it's just annoying. Right? But if you come up to someone and say, after a talk, a bigwig at the end of the talk, that was really good. That was inspiring. Thank you very much. My name is. And I work for. Thank you so much for a great talk. Now you've made the introduction. 2 months later, you see the person at the conference again. They might recognize you. Maybe they don't. And if they don't, you walk up and say, that was great. I enjoyed it. I saw you back in so-and-so. Right? Now they know you're at this conference. You see these things. You're in that community. You belong there. And then you can go out for coffee. Right? It's a process. Right? It's a process. It's not, I'm important. I'm as important as you are. You're not. I'm not as important as Bob Langer. Good. That's fine, right? There's a hierarchy, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Know where you are in the hierarchy and work your network so that you can get where you want to be.
I just want to jump in with every week, there's one set of people I always touch base with. And these are the people who on LinkedIn, the opportunity comes up saying, looking for new opportunity. They've just been laid off, all right? This is when you help people. I send them a note. Hey, I understand you're looking for something. Are you looking to stay in that area? Are you looking to move out, the field, the geography? When you help somebody find a new position, they remember it forever.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, that's when the stress, that's when you go home and you tell your spouse, I've lost my job, but somebody's reached out to me on day one. Okay, that's a critical part of what I do. That's more important than trying to get in touch with, you know, the president of such and such. Because these are the people, they go back, they move on, they never forget this. Okay, your ability to help out. You're not quite at that life stage yet where you have the ability to help them, but I want to point out that it is a give and take. It's not just a, LinkedIn is a powerful tool for spreading yourself very thin, right? That's, you can misuse it, right? It's, view it like a, it's a mailbox that's very easy to keep up with. It's not, I'm not advocating it as a networking, you know, end all. But that's a group that comes to mind immediately. These are the people that I know, you know, working with a company spread around the world. I have a lot of contacts and I can connect people who I know in my network when they're looking at the critical time.
Okay. That was some great advice. At this time, we want to open up to the audience if they have questions.
Okay. Sorry, the newspaper every day. And every now and again, you see op-eds that talk about industry and entrepreneurship in this country. And so I read the Wall Street Journal, which is kind of conservative. And they always say, you know, the FDA is a nightmare to work with. There's a talent shortage. There's too many regulations to start businesses. So I wanted to get your opinion and input on whether or not you feel that those things are true, that there is a talent shortage in this country in terms of skill development in graduate school and in college to prepare them for their job afterwards, or if there's too many regulations to start your own business and it's very difficult.
We're in order again. I think, I don't know, somebody up here said it earlier about the quality of the idea, or maybe it was in any conversation before. So we'll start with that part of it. A quality idea will always draw support towards it. So in terms of, you know, something getting started from scratch, it's always going to be, it's going to ride on the quality of the idea. No matter what how the economy is doing, no matter how, you know, the job situation is, if there's a good idea that comes along, it'll find a way out. I mean, I strongly believe that, and that there's a lot of data to point towards that. In terms of, is there a shortage of quality personnel? I think some of these people here are probably better suited to answer that question, but I'll say that I'll say from a startup standpoint, if I'm bringing somebody into the company, he can't just have one specialization. He has to. We're looking at a broad kind of knowledge base, and also an openness to take on new things. It can be a little scary in that respect because we're looking for we have a need, and we'll interview and we'll say, okay, we need you to do this, but at the same time we might need you to push out into marketing. We might need you to push because it's early stage company. You're going to have to do a lot of things. So in our case, it's the people that we're looking for are not easy to find because we need people with core competency, but also, you know, kind of knowledge in other areas also. We need them to be personable because we need them to fit into the skill. We need them to have low ego. There's so many things that we look for. It's very hard to find somebody to match into what we need. Now, as I said, the other people will talk about, on the panel will talk about specific industries in particular. In my industry, we're just growing it. And, you know, there's another part to your question. It was personnel, opportunities, and was there one other thing?
Regulatory environment.
Yes. In any area that you go into, there is obviously regulatory issues. Part of getting into any part of technology is to understand what the regulations are. As I said earlier, we work with a radioactive battery, so there's a little bit more regulation there than most, and a little bit, we talked about public perception of radioactivity and what it is. So going forward, that's been, from day one, that's been a big part of our whole knowledge gathering and planning going forward. is to understand the regulations in our industry. Is it overregulated? If you ask someone from 20 years ago, they're always going to say there are more regulations today, you can't do anything. Is there necessity for changes in regulation? For the most part, I know that the things that I deal with since 9/11, things have changed significantly. So there are always sea changes that occur in any kind of regulatory environment that you always have to be aware of. I don't think there's too much regulation. I think you have to understand it and learn, just like anything else, how to work within it.
As far as the commentary on talent goes and entrepreneurship, the United States does not have that issue. And I don't see that issue in Europe either. Some of the Asian cultures are less willing to go out and promote themselves and ask for money. And that is a cultural difference. This is why there aren't as many biotechnology companies in Japan. I mean, there are certainly a wealth of brilliant people that are working there, but it's against their culture to really get out there and say, I have a great idea, I'm going to push this forward, I'm going to do these experiments, you got to invest now. It just doesn't work. And you can talk to Japanese venture capitalists, there are only a handful, and they will tell you that, you know, this is something's been tried and true. It's cultural, as the different cultures from China, Japan, and others do education pieces in the United States. I think that this will be overcome in time, and you will have truly trained entrepreneurs going back to Asia, going back to their home roots, and really making a difference in this scenario. And as far as regulatory goes, I could just say that they're people. Yes, they're rules. They're rules and regulations, but they're people. And these are government-paid employees that are working very long hours with very low resources, not very nice offices, not very good pay, so on and so forth. So read between the lines here and say, yes, the rules are the rules. It's a little bit of a leveling of the playing field, though, because you're going to deal with the same regulatory bodies as a small company, say a biotech that's trying to bring forward a drug for Alzheimer's disease, as the Pfizer's are and as the Johnson & Johnson's are. So it's a little bit of leveling the playing field. And it's really, you have to remember the rules are the rules. They're the same rules for Pfizer as they are for the small biotech. But you're dealing with the people that are your regulatory sponsors that have been assigned to you from the FDA. And if you are really nice to them, realizing the stress and pressure they're under, yes, that would have been my second advice. Always be nice to people. And I've been at companies, you know, Pfizer was really pretty good. They, you know, you're sucking up to these people. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You are sucking up to these people. And if they call you and they want some information, you are back to them within an hour. And that was policy within Pfizer. Boehringer Ingelheim had a very different attitude about it. Being a German company, they would respond to the EMA very quickly, but if the FDA called up, they may take a week to get back to them. And this all has an influence on how the regulatory people will treat you and your application. So again, always be very nice to people and appreciate that the regulatory rules and the agencies and so on are people. They're people that you're going to be dealing with, and they're people that are under a great deal of pressure, at least in the United States. And I assume the EMA, too. I know in China, the regulatory body is extremely small for all the different applications that are going into the Chinese agency. And it just, you know, people can only do so much. They can only do so much. So I would say be nice to people. Be nice to the regulatory body, people. Really nice to them.
Those bodies are going to get larger very quickly.
I'm not large enough for them.
Well, congratulations on reading the Wall Street Journal. Very well. I don't know what happened a couple of years ago. There must have been some change of ownership because it certainly took a very different tilt in the past few years. Snicker, snicker. It definitely errs on the side of complaining about government regulation. I would say business doesn't fear regulation as much as uncertainty. If the regulations are changing every 6 months, that's nasty in the boardroom. If you know what the rule book is and the playing field is, even though it's overregulated and you whine about it in expensive wine tastings, it's not really a big business concern. Again, you know your competitors have to do it. When I used to josh with my spar with my conservative friends over healthcare, I learned a very good pitch to throw at them was, you realize that we're paying twice as much per capita for healthcare as our European competitors. What if our engineering costs were twice as much as Europe? Would we think that's a good business situation? And they would all look at their shoes and think about that. I mean, it's an indirect cost, and it was twice as much. I mean, from a business perspective, you just, that's unacceptable. If your competitor's doing something at half your cost, you have a big problem, right? So again, regulation, I don't think, is the throttling force, so certainly not on innovation, certainly not on startups. Is there a talent shortage? You know, you can't assemble a group of sort of brain power like this, what we have in this room, too easily. You know, you guys are at the top of the pyramid. In my view, the problem business faces in the States and in Europe is finding the talent. And it sounds ridiculous because, of course, everybody wants, you know, you're out, I could do your job, I want to be found. But at the risk of going out on a limb, we've kind of lost our way of having effective hiring strategies. And the larger the company gets, the worse it gets. We used to have managers who their number one job was to staff their departments. I think my personal opinion is the hiring practices got pushed into a boardroom status. We created the department that used to do payroll and used to do benefits. We created this thing called human resources and we passed hiring to them. And the hiring of a small group, a manager cannot effectively manage more than about 10 professionals, some would say five, but certainly 10. That person has to know that team. You don't hire, the group is not the sum of the components. It's the operating efficiencies and the synergies of that 10 people. And a human resources person who doesn't understand the function of that department cannot effectively input on that, in my humble opinion. So going back to hiring, getting in touch with the hiring manager, this is the pain feels in this world, that I'm constrained by corporate things, by legalities. I can't ask this question, I can't ask this question. I've asked many illegal questions in interviews, okay? Because the most important thing for me, I'd rather take the risk that I'm going to be sued to get the best person I can find. All right. Companies that do that do well. Companies that take the conservative approach and say, look, if we get somebody in here and they, but we don't get sued, we've succeeded. You know, yikes. Wow, that is not a good formula. Trying to remember the quote so I don't mess it up. Oh, yes. The CFO, what if we hire and train these people and they leave? And the CEO, what if we hire and don't train them and they stay? Anyway, but no, I don't think there's a lot of good people out there. We're having trouble linking them to the jobs. The hiring, there's recognition of that fact that we're having trouble getting the people into the positions where they're needed. But the solutions that are being thrown out is an onslaught of recruiters. I mean, the recruiting business has grown exponentially, right? All that's happened is they've taken the cost of hiring and kicked it down the road and said, well, I can hire this person to generate, you know, resume streams. And they hire more people, and every time the recruiting dollar gets divided, the effectiveness of the strategy gets weaker and weaker because there's less money to go around. And you've got to break that cycle, and the networking again is the key. You know, looking for the position, finding a company to work in with a culture that's good, and then waiting for the right opportunity. We all have bills to pay. You can't wait 5 years for a job to open, which is why when you're in grad school, you've got to start that process early.
So I'm in the academic world and in the small company world, so I can't speak to what these other panelists have expertise on. But I see starting companies as playing chess. My talent is my knight, and my regulation is my bishop, and you know, money is king. That's a joke. But the and so you play your pieces, regulation is just part of that piece, right? And so you play your pieces to win. And the successful entrepreneur is going to be the person who can win with a king and a pawn against the full board on the other side, right? That's a hallmark of a successful entrepreneur, because they'll find the way to get through that onslaught of regulation and money and financing and infrastructure and talent, and they're going to weed around it, they're going to find a way around it, they're going to do it legally, and they're going to do it well, and they're going to win. That's the way I look at it. I think that both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal like to whine a lot just to sell papers.
So I guess one of the impressions that I've gotten, sort of related to the talent question posed, I guess, is that maybe historically industry was more willing to hire and train new people and to get different skill sets that they're looking for, whereas nowadays it seems that they want to only hire people who already have those skills and are experienced with them. Do you have any recommendations how to get around this if you are someone who's interested in acquiring new skills but maybe doesn't have the opportunity to easily do so? Or are there any recommended outlets to try to develop new skills?
I have a very specific answer to that question, if you
yeah,
guys
go
don't mind. So it depends upon what company you're, what level of company you're looking for, right? Large companies have the ability to train, small companies don't. They need someone with a very specific skill set. The way to get the job, even if you don't have the skill set, is to say, look, this company is fantastic, and this is the reason why I think it's fantastic. These are my skills, right? And they want to hire someone who's going to be motivated and wants to be at that company that can bring the ability to work with a team and maybe not have that specific skill set, but be very, very smart and motivated to work for that team. Even if you don't have those skill sets, they'll hire you. Right. If you're smart. If you're stupid, then you're gonna get fired. But in general, that if you show the motivation, even if you don't have that specific skill set, you'll get hired.
There are a lot of internship programs too. Not all of them are paid, so they're not all as attractive as you would like. But if you are really passionate about developing your skill set and you know what that skill set that you'd like to pick up is, to go and make that passionate argument, as has just been articulated, is absolutely the way to go. And to say, you know, try me out for 6 months. You don't have to pay me for the first three. This is something I'm super passionate about. This is my background. This is what I already know I can contribute. And this is what I really want to learn. And I think this is the optimal place to learn it. That's what they're looking for, the fire in your belly. They're looking for your passion. They're looking for your commitment. They're looking to make sure that you're not just going to try to get a paycheck and skate by, but you're really going to get in there and focus and try to make a contribution. And I agree, smaller companies, they're really hamstrung. Where it would be wonderful to have somebody come in and train them up, you need to have somebody come in and hit the ground running. One of the companies I work with is only 7 people. So every single person has a specific role that they have to fulfill. And there's no way that we could actually afford to bring in someone like that. But Pfizer and Boehringer Ingelheim, both companies took in a lot of interns, and they were paid internships. So, you know, being a graduate student is a vow of poverty for quite a while. And I appreciate that. But it's a great way to expand your skill set.
Just one comment on the intern route. The company should have skin in the game, right? You don't go and say, I'll do this for free.
Yeah.
And we'll see how it works out. It should be I could do it for 3 months, you pay me for the next 3 months, and at the end of the 6 months, we agree to see if I become permanent. That's important, right? Come to the table as an equal, not with your hat in your hand. I'm sorry. What was the original question? I wanted to ask that too.
I was just wondering about how, at least my impression is that historically companies are much more willing to take on people who are, you know, maybe just have a certain degree and train them to be what they're looking for, whereas nowadays it seems like the training process is a little bit less common.
Yeah, definitely a small big company break, as BJ pointed out. However, the fact is when you go into pretty much any environment, your job responsibilities morph in 12 months, 24 months on the max.
Days.
It can be much faster. So again, no one's looking for an exact match. Or I should say, if a company's looking for an exact match, you probably don't want to work there, right? Because they are demonstrating they don't know how to hire. You know, they are following the formula of writing a job description, I'll come back to that in a second, and then wondering down the road when the needs change, well, we didn't get the right person, they can no longer help us with that problem. Writing of the job description is not a trivial thing. It's you know, steeped and stenched with politics, and you know, sometimes these things are just boilerplates that are thrown out. So when you read these things and you say, well, I can't do that, I need not apply, you're following that traditional route of going through a paperwork that you're never going to match, probably because you know, the whole process is flawed. You know, the person who's written that job description does not have intimate knowledge of what that group needs because it's been corrupted by the corporate environment. To really do an extreme example, my wife worked in government years ago, and there was an agency where literally the job descriptions for agencies were written by a member of the agency that was in a different state, okay? And the job descriptions would come back and you'd look at them and you'd say, where did they come up with this? This is not what we need. But you were forced by that. You were constrained by that bureaucracy. And that happens in the corporate environment. The job descriptions are generic and they're thrown at you and you look and you say, so don't take them at face value. And again, if you take the direct approach where you've identified a company, now you have to identify hiring managers, and now what does a hiring manager do? And she sits in an interview and has a candidate. I'm less worried about, do I fit with this person? What's on my mind is, what's the problem that's facing my department that's giving me a headache that I have to solve this fiscal year? What's in this quarter, in the, you know, the next four quarters? And what's coming next year? Is this person going to be able to adapt and change and solve the problems that I need done? And that's what graduate school is all about, right? You've got a huge variety of problems surrounding you, huge amount of information that you get very skilled at dealing with this and getting your hands around a big block of problem. That's a very powerful skill set that's not found in people who don't get through this program. So that's your winning card, right? The fact that, okay, well, explain to me what you need done, and I'll explain to you how I might go about it. Now, if you approach an interview like that, even if you don't get it right, the manager won't care. That's a very different interview than going down saying, I played soccer in college and I like walks on the beach and you know, going through the resume review, right? That's an interview of, let's talk about the problem you have and how I'm gonna help you solve it, okay?
So I just wanted to interject. So I can only speak from a business development perspective, but as a graduate student or postdoc, there are a lot of groups out there that provide networking. So I'm thinking about the Association for Strategic Alliance Professionals. It's called ASAP. It's on the web. Richard Cizanetti? I know the president of it, but I'm blanking on his name right now. He used to work for me. That's how good a manager I am. But if I had somebody that came in at your level and had taken the incentive, taken the responsibility to go and connect with these groups, the LES, Licensing Executive Society, there are chapters, I'm sure there's a chapter in Upper State New York that would be in this area, Alliance of, as I said, Association of Strategic Alliance Professionals. That would be pretty impressive to me, that, you know, you're already thinking out of your box. They're usually societies and groups that you don't get into until you have a job in that field, but what a great way to be at least introduced to the problems that those types of agencies or groups are facing and forming. And they're always academic rates. So you can join as an individual at an academic rate, so it's not gonna break the bank. And I can't speak to the other industries, but I'm sure that there are similar.
I think everything's been said here.
Type things.
There's also, if you're interested in connecting with internships, talking with Susie through the BEST program, that's also a great opportunity as well.
I might ask one question in relation to what some of you just mentioned. So at the interview stage, it's much easier to approach the hiring manager and ask specific questions in terms of what are your problems, how can I address these problems. From the general, you know, stage one of applying and looking at these job solicitations, looking at your own skills, and seeing how your skills can apply to them, in terms of penetrating the barrier that is HR, it can be quite difficult to actually ascertain what the company is, like you said, actually looking for and what sort of problems that they're actually in positions that they're trying to fill, like specific barriers that they'd like to overcome with their candidates. How can you look at a solicitation that's very general and sell your skills in a way in which you can show that you're appropriate for it when there is that sort of corporate changing of the initial solicitation, if that makes sense?
So that's where your network comes into play. You know, it's a very difficult thing to actually build and maintain a network. But this is why we're saying start it now. Because the best possible way to get through that HR checkbox criteria is to know somebody. And so when I'm looking at a candidate, I go and look at the company they're working on, I look at who's on the board, who's in the management, who do I know there, I'm gonna give them a call, I'm gonna see what happens. And I have done the same for young folks such as yourself too, where if I've gotten to know them and they say, I'm really interested in this company, I say, oh, I know somebody there, let me just give them a call and see what happens. That works, trust works faster than the speed of light. So it really is essential to try to build as many relationships as you can.
I just wanted to add, if you've waited for the job rec to come out, you're too late.
You're too late.
Okay, probably 30% of the job recs are probably not even real jobs. They're solicitations that are thrown out where the position is not yet funded, it's not yet in the budget, it's not signed off, or it's a preliminary budget and it's gonna get axed, in which case no hire will be made. Another 30%, and I'm throwing these numbers out a bit widely, but they're gonna be filled internally. They've already identified somebody. It can be much more in some industries. So waiting for that stage is very late in the game and it's low probability, okay? That's why, you know, discovering the problem, the person that you might be working for in an organization that you've identified 2 years before you start day one is the key, okay? That person will talk to you. You have to have faith in that because they have problems. You know, turnover in a good economy is 5 to 10%, much higher in some industries, which means if I'm managing 10 professionals, I have to replace one or two in the next 2 years. You have to spend time in your, every good manager will spend 20 to 30% of their time with a pipeline, right? Just talking to people, knowing they have to replace from either internal promotion or from people departing. And that's the key. You know, they want to talk to people. They want it to be easy. They don't want to have to go out and look, all right? The references on request thing at the bottom of your resume, that's probably one of the worst lines I like because the time for your reference, I left a company a few years ago, the CFO and I left together. I was actually buying product from somebody in that same town, and I called the CEO, I was dealing with a salesperson, I called the CEO just to compliment the salesperson on their professionalism, make no enemies, right? And I said, by the way, you're a small company, I know your size, how do you handle your financial side? And he said, that's a real problem for me right now. Right, right now I'm handling it as CFO, CEO. That's my pain, okay? And I said, I know someone you should talk to. I know lives in this town. Let me connect you, right? The reference was not the thing at the end of the process after you've interviewed and, oh, I better call to make sure this person's not a serial murderer, right? The reference was the beginning of the process. And there's no more powerful reference than, you should talk to this person. You know, I'm buying from you, but you should talk to this person. I think they can help you with this problem. And he was in the job 3 weeks later, right? So, yeah, it's early. The job requisition is a very, you know, low probability document if you're waiting to that stage. You start with the company, identify companies
often with the two-body problem, you have geographical constraints. You know, you've got to look at your partner and say, where are we going to live? Who's going to do what? We all go through that. I followed my wife to Albany. So it's certainly easier now than it was. I think there's much less stigma about that now than even 20 years ago. But if you've got a geographic location, nowadays, now you can go and say, okay, where can I work? What are the opportunities that exist? And then you have to get on LinkedIn or contact your contacts to say, who do I need to talk to in this company to get going and get around that process. Some people aren't comfortable with that. They think, well, am I end running it? Well, you have to self-advocate, you know, believe me, because the other process is just not fair to you either. It's a waste of your time.
I don't want to hijack here, but does that make you a little bit nervous? Like, especially if you have 9,000 contacts and someone says, oh, I need somebody who can do this. I know somebody, I might not know them that well. I don't want to put them in your company if they're going to do bad, because then they'll reflect negatively on you, right?
Well, I worked with them for 5 years.
Well, yeah, for that situation, but...
That's my professional reputation, and that's a very large value of what I do. So I am very careful, indeed. I met them at a seminar type. I have to, and you're back to networking, right? I have to know them personally, or I have to know people that I trust implicitly to say, could I send this person over there? What are their strengths and weaknesses, right?
And it's okay to say no too. Mm-hmm. I can't, I don't know anybody, or, you know, if you're not certain, if it's just somebody you just met and you don't know it enough, you know, you have to find a way to handle that, because you can't recommend somebody that you don't know that well.
So first I just wanted to say, you know, you all mentioned that we're ahead of the game by being in this room, but I wanted to say that you are too. And I just want to acknowledge and thank you for being here and being willing to flip the hierarchy a little bit and, you know, treat us as equals in that respect. Second, what I noticed to be common in all of your stories is that you all came into entrepreneurial positions or managerial positions almost by happenstance. You didn't go into these roles expecting to fulfill them. And what that proves to me is that you're all willing and able to differentiate between doing what's necessary and doing what's important. And what I see you all to be doing is doing what's necessary. And in doing so, it becomes important. But being able to see that distinction from the beginning, I think, puts you ahead and set you on those paths more confidently. So I just wanted to ask you, do you agree with that, you know, characterization? And if so, how might we at this stage make that distinction strategically?
That's a good question.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
BJ will start with that one.
It's really interesting because As you said, you know, I certainly had no expectations of ever being a vice president, senior vice president, CEO. Never, never, never. And going into any role, no matter where you are, what you're doing, it's a corollary of being nice to people. But I would always, people would call me up, and maybe they wanted to yell at me, maybe they wanted to prod me to do something faster. Whatever it is they wanted, I would always say, what can I do for you? You know, so put yourself in the subservient position, irrespective of the level or title of who was on the other side of the phone. Just, what can I do for you? That softens up people so much, I can't even tell you. And the other thing that I learned, and this is probably a big company thing, not a small company thing, is I would see interactions between my colleagues that were doing the same type of job that I was doing, and scientists or someone, and I would hear my colleagues say, well, that's not our job. We don't do that. I have never said that in my life.
Yeah.
It's always, well, I don't know about that, but let me see what I can do to help. And I actually drove a whole new division of Pfizer just by doing a job that my colleagues wouldn't do. They wouldn't do it. So it's amazing. And my 22-year-old daughter, who works in marketing on Fifth Avenue in New York City, she and I had a conversation a couple months ago, and she said, oh, yeah, this nasty woman called me up from this other department and wanted me to do A, B, and C, and I told her we didn't do that. And she got the lecture, you know. She got the whole lecture. But I think that that's what creates, you create your own opportunity. You don't even know you're doing it. But if you just Say, what can I do to help you?
Right.
And then do it. Help them. And if you really run into a brick wall and you say, I've talked to this person and this person, I don't think I'm in a position to help you, but maybe this person can. I'd be happy to make an introduction. But do what you can to help this person, even if it's something you've never done before.
I think the way you worded that was quite interesting and was very thought-provoking. And obviously, BJ went right there in terms of the responsibility part of things. You mentioned earlier that you shouldn't say that you played soccer in college. I actually played soccer in college.
I did too.
And was a professional soccer player. Played for Jamaica in World Cup qualifying.
Wow.
Yeah. And my background is elite athletics. So I have that naturally, you know, just to say if something needs to be done, you have to do it right away. I mean, you cannot advance in that area unless you're like that. I mean, over time, you get into that viewpoint of there's something that needs to be done, you know, you have to take care of it. So when I heard you just say that you've never said, I can't do that, there's so many times when you're in a conversation and somebody's saying this needs to be done, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, I know I have to do this and I have to do that. Can I find the time? We were talking about time management earlier. Can I find the time to do this, or how long I can do that? And my answer might be, okay, how quickly do you need that to be done? Because I might be able to do it, but I'm going to have to do it. You know, it's never, we can't do it. And so that whole thing of impossible and not being able is not really something that I look at. I have to investigate first before I can say definitively it can't be done or I can't do it. And I think that's something that opens a lot of opportunities. It really open, and not only that, you talk about your networking. That's one of the ways that your networking really grows, because when somebody's talking to you just casually and they mention a problem, you could end up in the next hour conversation just going back and forth about how maybe you tried this. And you'd be surprised how those conversations can be very helpful. You, at the end of it, you haven't really done anything, but you've really taken your mind and put it on the table for him to pick and to pull pieces of it from. And so that attitude of being always locked in or willing to be locked in is very important, and very, especially when it goes, you know, not just in terms of interacting mentally, but also physically, and you doing things, is very important. It's a very thought-provoking question.
You're back to that Silicon Valley mantra, which, you know, is, and Harold Edgerton, who did the, everyone knows that time-lapse photography from MIT, but he had a lot of good business snippets. One of them was tell everyone everything you know. And this was the same attitude that when you get into that collection of people, well, what's your problem? What are you facing? And let me hear about it, and let me tell you what I know about it. Even if it's nothing, have you tried this? Is it a stupid idea that you haven't thought of? And the carryover in the Silicon Valley environment is this is what goes on every day. Right? People just throw their ideas and their concept. Maybe we should do this. You know, maybe if we did rideshare on the web, you know, we could put taxis out of business. You know, crazy idea like that. I'm having a little trouble. I'm still struggling trying to decide the necessary from the important. There's a lot of meat in what you asked, and I appreciate that, but I have to noodle on that. When did I start changing? You know, certainly I was much more curiosity driven in grad school, and I don't know, you know, when that transition happened. If it was too long ago. I'm going to play the age card. But it certainly, yeah, you have to prioritize getting back to time management. You have to, there are constraints that are put on you, things that you have to do, and you no longer have the timelines and the freedom that you have in school. You know, obviously in these environments, there's just things that have to be done, and you don't want to get caught in that mode, right? Well, I wanted to do this because this was cool, the paper was out, that's bad. It's not my job is a phrase which you just have to strike from your vocabulary.
Oh, God,
that can
yeah.
just never, ever be said. And yet, you know, it's a perfect opportunity to shine, right? Well, I want you to do this. I want you to go do this Western blot. Well, I'm a laser guy. I don't even know what a Western blot is. I'd be glad to help you with that. I'm going to need help on these aspects of it. Who in the department could I talk to who could help me do that? You know, very different, you've got a problem, you've given me that problem to solve. It's way out of my expertise, you stupid something. But I'm going to solve it anyway, right? I just need resources. I mean, I'm being using a bit of hyperbole, but.
I think that's a really good example. So that's one of the other lessons learned or life lessons learned. If I'm getting into something that I know nothing about, you sit down with the people that do and say, please, give me the Sesame Street version. I need to know the basics. And I can just relate to one situation. I was doing some business development work for the scale-up chemists at Pfizer. I'm not a chemist. I'm a biologist. And I walked into a symposia like this. There were probably 40 people in the room. The whiteboard was covered with structures, all kinds of arrows going. And I took organic chem, but that was like a long time ago. And I hated it. Then I was so glad it was over, and I never wanted to see it again. And here I am. And they're going through, and the guy makes a joke. He's pointing to a molecule, and he said, they wanted to use boron, you know, and the whole room breaks out in laughter. I have absolutely no idea what just transpired, and that was the first time in my life after everybody broke up and I had to talk to the leader of the group about doing this contract work or whatever. I said, please, I can't help you if I know nothing, and I know nothing. You have to give me the Sesame Street version. It is amazing how warm people treat you when you actually are a little bit humble and say, I know you can help me. I need an hour of your time. You just got to take me through the basics, and then I will do whatever I can to help you. So that is extremely well received. People don't think you're stupid. They just think you're really reaching out and know your limits and know what you don't know. And I, to this day, I don't know that joke, and it really bothers me. But it's good experience to say, please help me.
There's a great follow-up there for somebody to send BJ an email finding out what that joke is.
I don't know what it is.
I have a very different answer to your question. And it has to do with balancing your professional life with your personal life. You said the words necessary and you said important. And there are two things that are necessary and important to me, and that's why I cannot fail as a husband and I cannot fail as a father. Those are the two things that are necessary and important. I do this job because I choose to. I don't have to do this job. I do it because this is something that I really enjoy. I love teaching, I love doing research, and this is something I love Cornell, but this environment is bloody fantastic. I get recruited all the time to go to different places. You go around and talk to people, and you come back here and you say, you know what, this is a really good place to do the work that I do. So I choose to be here. So having that active mindset of, I choose to be here, oh, this job is difficult, oh, this job is hard, I choose to do it, and I don't have to do it. Are there 50 other jobs out there that I could do that would be probably just as happy? Yes. Right, I grew up in a dairy farm 2 hours north of here. I would have no problem milking cows at 5 o'clock. To me, that's fun. That's fun. Right? And so necessary and important, the work that I do, I do because I think it's important. Otherwise, I would have no reason to do it. And it's fun, but I don't have to.
I believe he had a question previously, and then we'll go over there.
So my question relates to time management and prioritization. I'm interested in starting my own company, and so the question I have with that is that right now I'm also a grad student, and so my question relates to both grad students, postdocs, like dead professors, industry. If you're trying
Did you
to
say dead professors, okay.
But so the question is, if you're starting your own company, it kind of is something like so you want to succeed very badly, let's say. And so it could be hard to stop thinking about it. And so let's say one way to go about it, in my case, would be do like 8 to 5 or 8 to 6, do grad school work, and after that work on your company. But that is somewhat hard, as in 8 to 6, my brain is still thinking about it, my company. So is there any tips you have for that? Or
I actually did this. This is exactly what I did. So I was a postdoc. I worked from 7 to 5 as a postdoc, and then I ate dinner, and then I worked 6 till whenever the work was done on the company. And then when the company started, I flip-flopped my schedules. So I stayed a postdoc. I did the company stuff during the day, and I did the postdoc stuff at night. You can't turn it off. They're always going to be ingrained. It's just, what are you focusing on now? You want to go do this other thing? I need to think about this for the company, right? Put a pin in it. Put it in the back of your mind, and your subconscious is going to work on it while you're doing the thing you need to focus on. So it's discipline is what it is, right? I need to do this now, but I really want to be doing that, right? But when you're doing that, you want to be doing this. And it's always going to be back and forth. So just put the, you have to say, you actively have to say to yourself, I am doing this right now. I can think about that later. And when you do that, it goes in the back of your head. Your subconscious will work on it, and you'll actually do the other thing better when you get the chance to focus on that. All right, didn't mean to hijack it, but that's exactly what I did.
No, that's correct. I mean, I went through the same thing. As I said, my company was started when I was still a PhD student here. And you divvy up the time according to how you can spend it. My project was particularly demanding because I ran a CVD reactor, which required a lot of time, not just for doing the actual runs, but maintenance. And you're flip-flopping between what you're thinking about. I mean, obviously, in the times when it's maintenance, you can't focus on anything else. But yes, you have to set aside time to work on your company, to think through the ideas that you have to do there, you know, write grants if you have to. And the synergy of having the area be close to what you're working on, if you're fortunate, it helps to focus things a little bit better. But there's no way around it. You're going to be doing a lot of hours if that's what you want. And you have to be okay with that.
I'm going to throw a caveat onto that, because if I tried to do grad school in a company, it's hard to imagine doing that, you know, later in life, I would have been a tremendous fail. And looking back, I'm going to throw this out there for your consumption. If you look at when you have a task, a fairly complex task, and you can accurately estimate your time, and I'm going to say accurately within 10%, 20%. If you can estimate the time and come in on time budget, I think you could do that. I couldn't do that. I struggle with this today. I can take twice as long to do something as I think. It could be I haven't fully mastered it good enough. You know, better is the enemy of good enough, which is an important concept. But I know that if you can't do that, if you're 2X, that's a recipe for disaster, trying to do both things. I admire you guys for starting while you're in grad school and postdoc. I mean, I waited till later, and I obviously had a lot more business experience before I went into this route. But I suspect that's the case, that trying to manage that, if you can't accurately manage these tasks, which is a very difficult thing for me, that would be very difficult. I don't think I had an environment. When I was in school, I didn't have an option to go and work. You know, we were expected, did very long hours. I don't know if that's an environment change or if we're more open now to entrepreneurial ideas in school than the Dark Ages, the Jurassic era. I hope it is, but that's my feeling on that, is again, coming back to time management, how accurate you can be. And you have to be honest with yourself, obviously. But that would be a difficult hurdle, I know, for me to overcome even now.
I couldn't do it. So. I have no advice to give you.
If we could take one more quick question.
So I think being a company and having a company should be really different. So, in your personal opinion, what is a good and bad thing
that
happens
compared
to
being in a company? Could you repeat that? I didn't quite catch it.
So, being in a company, being as an employee in a company, and working as a CEO or the founder for a company, there should be some good and bad thing, being in a company as an employee. Being a CEO, so what would be the bad side and good side?
I've never been a CEO, so I'm going to get a cup of coffee.
Well,
let me start with this startup, because I'm on the bottom, right? In terms of number of employees and everything else, right? So I think one of the best things about it when you start in the beginning is ignorance, and one of the worst things about it is ignorance, because you find out quickly the bulk of what you need to do, and that could, if I knew that in the beginning, I probably would have been a little bit more daunted. But that, so that I was a little, probably a little bit more brave than I thought I was in the beginning if I knew everything. But then once you get to, I felt like that ignorance part, you had to become comfortable with it because there's just no way you can know everything. You were talking about that earlier. You have to, you know, your area of expertise, you're clear on that. And once you step out that, you have to be quickly aware of where your edges are. And in terms of understanding that, I found that to be very valuable. So when you start to interact with someone, you can say at this point, okay, beyond, I understand this up to this point. I understood everything you just said. But this last part that you just talked about, I don't get it. Now, once they explain something to you or give you some more background of it, it's your job to then go back and just make sure that the next time you interact with that person, you're way beyond where you were before. So, I would say that real quickly that, you know, starting out, ignorance allowed me to really be brave and to go forward and to think that I could do much more than I could in the first 2 years. And also, once I came to grips with that same ignorance, I realized that it's being able to interact with someone who is an expert in another field from yours. I mean, I think you learn that over time and you get more comfortable with that. In that someone can be an expert in another area different from yours, and if you have to interact with them, there's a way to interact that is not demeaning to either of you. As long as you can define clearly where your edges are, and they're defined clearly where their edges pointed out for you, then you can find a common ground. Because innovation usually comes from two different areas at least. And so when you have different people with expertise in different areas, if you can find a way to discuss things and to put it in a framework that allow you to find and really push each other and complement each other, you can come to a place where the ideas that you come up with are really innovative and really helpful going forward.
So my answer may be a little bit gender driven, and that's not a qualifier that I use. It's a qualifier I use rarely, very, very rarely. When I'm in Japan and I don't want to eat the raw whatever it is in front of me, I'll say, oh, I'm a woman, I don't want to gain any weight, you know, blah, blah, blah. Food's delicious, it works great. Anyway, but I would have to say, being in the CEO role, I don't mind failing. I will work flat out and put my heart into everything, and I will, you know, pick up my head off, nose off the grindstone every now and then and say, what can I do better? You know, this doesn't seem to be going well. You know, what's going on? And I'm not afraid of failing or analyzing that. When you're CEO, though, and you have other people in the company that are counting on you, that's the hardest part for me. It's the responsibility of all the folks that are with you and that are, they're, you know, working as hard as they can to make sure that you're successful. And if you fail, you have failed personally. And again, you know, I've had so many failed experiments in my life and so on. You get used to that, and the data are the data, so you change your hypothesis. When you're a CEO and you've now failed in a failing company, yes, you can analyze the situation, but the other people that have been with you for this period of time to try to get funding, to try to promote the idea, to try to get the feet on the ground, it's that's stressful for me. That's stressful for me. It keeps you going, but it's also stressful, and that would be, you know, I don't want to ever say I'm afraid to fail, but you are afraid to fail because you're afraid of letting down these people that are counting on you.
Yeah, taking the ownership of responsibility, having to lay people off because you've made bad business decisions, it's very hard to wear that on your sleeve. If you don't take that too personally, then I don't have a lot of respect for you, frankly. It's a very personal, painful thing to have to do. You have to do it for the good of the rest of the other people working there. By contrast, firing people for cause because they can't do the job or because of conduct, it's sort of acutely more painful, but you quickly realize you have to do this because, again, it's a poison to the people who are there and doing their job, and it's still painful. The first time I did it, I remember I was a basket case for a week, but it's something that's necessary. The laying off when you've really made bad decisions, or you know, you can't point to the economy and say the economy went bad. You don't get that pass when you're at the top. It's just the way it is, and you know you that's something that's the downside. Those are the bad days. for me personally, the good part was, I mean, I managed to raise my kids in one school district in one town, and that was a really important goal to me, the number one goal at the top, because I was very conscious I wanted to give them a stable environment and to grow up. I succeeded doing that. They go to college next year. I was under a lot of pressure early in my career to move out to the Valley to take a series of management roles. I was very lucky to have a mentor. He passed away a few years ago, but he was somebody who called me on the phone one day and just said, "This is not for you." He knew me very well, and he said, "I know you're thinking about doing this. This is not for you." And I was really lucky to have that advice, because he was absolutely right. And under the right circumstances, I could have been easily convinced the family to move and say, "I'm going to move into this job. I'm going to go up in a Fortune, you know, 500, and take that career path." So that was, you know, even the last 15 years. So I was lucky to have somebody who was looking out for me, you know, even though I'd been working in industry for 10 years, who knew that was not the right thing for me. And later on, he gave me advice to say, "When you see these things happening in your company, it's time to leave." And it was actually after he passed away, it was like clockwork. It's exactly how it happened. I saw this and I said, "Honey, you need to go back to work." And I left 2 years later, took another job. And again, I had some people looking out for me who knew that I was, probably avoided three major career mistakes. But being able to locate, you know, the flexibility and keeping the keeping the family in one spot was a number one priority for me, and I was happy, you know, I altered my work life to do that. There's no security in a big company. You feel very good because there's this big building and there's 1,000 people in it, and it's got a big brand name on the wall, and you think, "I'm doing my job here, I'm okay," until somebody at the top says, "Oh, you know what, Pfizer, we're no longer doing drugs, we're gonna become Uber," and I'm being extreme here. And they take your budget, and they go with a pen, and you come in and you swipe your card, and instead of going beep, the door goes erp. And that's a true, I'm not picking on Pfizer, that happened at a photonics company I know of. That was your notice that you'd just been laid off, okay? There's the security at the top in today's world, you know, is a myth. And I came to accept that, and I realized, well, I'd rather have the insecurity that I know than the insecurity that I can't see. So when I think of don't think that the upside of working at a big company is security. X, okay? There are upsides. There's obviously, it is the right environment for some people, but job security is not one of them.
So on that note, I'd like to thank our participants for coming. And I'd also can't thank enough for the panelists donating their time. I mean, over the course of the last hour and a half, it's been invaluable hearing your perspective, and at this point I think we have a good idea of exactly how busy all of your schedules are. So thank you for coming, and thank you, everyone.